surviving on the streets. Look at me, I'm in tatters.
All right, returning to our show on this segment is our good friend Sean Minton. Welcome back, Sean.
Oh, the pleasure's all yours.
You have proved to be Radio Parallax's answer to Frank DeFord. You have transcended sport, which is, of course, a somewhat trivial matter in American life to bring it into the mainstream.
Well, I listen to the program, and you talk to doctors, and you delve very deep into issues, and then I feel like I'm like the boil on the ass of the show, because I have to come in and do all the light stuff, because somebody else is doing all the heavy lifting for you.
Well, no, I think that sports and movies and things that we've talked about, you know, are something we all can relate to, and they impact American life.
Probably more than they should, if you think about it.
Well, that's kind of what I've thought, and didn't really see that we had a place for sports on this radio program. But doggone it, we've had some fun doing it, so we're going to take a stab at it again, and let's verify for the audience. You predicted on this show several weeks ago that there would be no baseball strike, and you appear to be the all-seeing seer from the East, Karnak the Magnificent.
Was that actually an on-air that I had, or was that something we were talking about off? I mean, I'm going to take full credit for it, don't get me wrong. Did I actually say it on the air, or did we have that conversation off the air?
Well, you know, actually, I believe it was off the air, but doggone it, you did say it.
I did say it. I'm not a psychic. I don't think most of, although I do play one on television, 976. No, but seriously, that was not an amazing feat on my part. I would say the majority of anybody who truly understood what was going on with the players and the owners, and more importantly, the situation taking place in our country right now, understand that there was not going to be a strike. Even though a strike date had been set, I believe that had they not come to that 11th hour agreement, roughly 3 hours before the strike was to have started, they would have come out and said, look, we're still negotiating. We're going to continue to play. There will be no strike. And they would have got that thing hammered out no matter what. When you look at the state of the economy with the stock market and unemployment, things going up and down, you've got 9/11 coming up.
Right.
It would have been not only a bad move for baseball, but in terms of just the psyche of this country with people wanting to remember what happened a year ago, it really just wiped everybody out.
Well, that's where sports sometimes, you know, it really does impact American life. We think of baseball as the national sport, and here was this idea a year after a time where America was brought together, when a bunch of prima donna millionaires were going to walk off in a so-called labor dispute, and people were actually angry at the owners for being a bunch of greedy guys, but they were even more angry, it seems, at the players.
In 1975, the average player salary was $51,000. In 2002, it's $2.3 million. So the player side, the players union, has done a great job of, you know, building up those salaries.
I guess.
This time in the negotiations, if you were to say who won the negotiations, you would say the owners won because of the luxury tax and because some of the other concessions they got with the steroid testing and things like that. Plus, this is a four-year contract. They've got a rollover phase on this, which means that at the end of 4 years, if they haven't come to a new agreement, they can both agree to roll this agreement over one more year, so you don't have this fiasco of the players coming forward,
no deadline,
setting a strike date. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the here and now. This is it. This is the way we see it. But the players, unlike the last four, five, six, seven times they've negotiated, actually kind of got the short end of the stick on this one.
But in the weeks beforehand, in the last few weeks, there's a lot of public opinion. They were asking people, a man on the street, what he thought about it. He was just saying, you know, I don't, you know, these guys, if they do this, to hell with them. I'm still not quite forgiving of what happened, you know, a few years back. And if they're going to do this again, really, you know, baseball can just be flushed.
That's a tough call, because every year they've said that there have been 9 work stoppages in baseball since 1972. And I would imagine every single time fans have said, if they do this one more time, every time, including the last one in 1984, the fans have come back. What happens is, I think more and more, 94. It takes them a little longer to come back each time.
Yeah.
But like the Pavlovian dog, they're going to keep coming back. Or in this case, the screaming cat in the background. But It's the nature. People love sports. They like the release. They like the fact that it pulls them away from the daily grind. They would have come back to baseball. Don't believe those people who say, I will never come back to this sport, because you talk to those people they'll do it.
But are the stats back? It seems like 94 hit them awfully hard, and it wasn't clear that they actually had recovered completely, had they?
Well, I don't know. I think part of that is you have to also look at the economics of baseball and the fact that it's ridiculously expensive for me to go to a baseball game as a middle-income type guy.
Yeah.
It's extremely expensive for a family of four, say, to go out and take their family to a baseball game. And so it's the economics of how do you spend your entertainment dollar versus not just the economics of do these guys make too much money?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that all goes hand in hand. They made, you know, the owners need to pay the salaries. They're going to up the ticket prices, the price of popcorn, the price of parking. But ultimately, it all falls back on the fan. And as the fan becomes a further distance from the game, less and less folks are going to go. I know that when I have to pay for a baseball game,
yeah,
I see two or three of them a year, mm-hmm, max. Mm-hmm. And that can be a $50 to $60 ordeal, and that's a lot of money.
Well, I guess in the old days, the baseball player was making seven times that of the working stiff, the average, mm-hmm, the wage earner, minimum wage type earner. I guess it was not minimum wage. It was actually like a factory worker, the average worker. The average baseball player was like seven times his income. Well, now it was 50 some time ago, and I don't know what it must be now, 2.4 million.
If you look way, way, way back, there was a time in the 30s and 40s and 50s where baseball players had normal jobs in the offseason. They weren't making enough just playing baseball, and so they had to have normal jobs in the offseason. Obviously, when DiMaggio and Williams and these guys came around and changed the economics of baseball, I know Babe Ruth, I think, was the first guy who had a $100,000 contract, right, back in the 20s.
Made more than the president.
In fact, he had a great quote about, I had a better year than he did. That was Babe Ruth's quote on how come he made
more money than President Hoover. I had a better year.
Exactly. So, you know, I think what comes around goes around, and people would have come back. I mean, that's my point. Regardless of whether there would have been a strike, people would have come back to the sport.
Well, they certainly do seem like the home run derbies, and as of this week, we see the A's on a winning streak breaking the record, mm-hmm, and I guess it generates a lot of fan interest, and maybe baseball will survive. And baseball's been written off now for some time by a lot of people.
The other big thing I would like to point out as a Minnesota Twins fan is the other portion of this contract that came out is there will be no contraction through the course of this contract through 2006. I think we had talked earlier, Doug, about the possibility of the Expos and the Twins being contracted.
Right.
And if people don't understand what that means, literally the franchise, their farm system, all their employees, literally just wiped out with nowhere to go because there was not the revenue for those two particular cities to go ahead and, mm-hmm, and keep a team functioning. Well, now you've got the Twins 16, 17 games up in the American League Central. The Expos aren't playing horribly, although they get about 9 people to show up in Montreal for their games. Chances are next year a group from Washington is going to probably move them down to the nation's capital, and they'll be just fine at that point.
We'll have a return to the old Washington Senators.
Absolutely.
Sean, let me ask you about something I've always thought was interesting. An alleged jinx that strikes those who appear on the cover of Sports Illustrated magazine. Many sports people, sports fans, and Americans believe this to be true. My dad did and heard about it when I was a kid, and over the years I've watched as example after example continued, and you did start to wonder.
Well, I don't believe, I think we share the belief that we don't believe in the jinx as a jinx itself, and yet as you delve a little bit deeper into the statistics that Sports Illustrated provided in an article they did on themselves.
Yes, this was actually the cover story, Sports Illustrated, January 21st of this year, mm-hmm, and they put a black cat on the cover and said the cover that no one would pose for. Is the SI jinx for real?
To finish off what you're saying, they'd ask several athletes to appear on the cover with the black cat, and nobody would do it. So I think that lends credence to the fact that even though the average person may not believe in a jinx, in the back of the athlete's mind, there is something there. And of course, sports is as much mental as it is physical.
Sure.
So,
what did Yogi Berra say on that? 90% of this game is half mental.
So there is something there. Is it a jinx? I don't know if you'd use the word jinx, but something is getting inside of these guys' heads, and it is affecting them, whether it's the next week, down the road. What's interesting about the jinx is it doesn't necessarily have to be a one-time thing, like as a golfer, okay, you put Tiger Woods on the cover, and he tanks the next tournament. We're talking about guys going into serious batting slumps for months at a time.
We're talking about ending injury.
Yeah. Death, for crying
death
out
in
loud.
Some cases, yes, yes.
So that
killed I would call in an air crash, yeah.
I would call that a little bit of a jinx if you appear on the cover of Sports Illustrated 1 week and you're shot to death the next. Maybe well, that's
I remember when the Niners were making their first run back like at becoming a successful team in the early 80s and they appeared on the cover of Sports Illustrated. My father was just groaning like, oh, no, they're finished now.
Yep. And my dad and myself, the same way. The Minnesota Vikings in the mid-70s and late-70s were a dominant football team. Unfortunately, 0-4 in Super Bowls. But every time they appeared on the cover of Sports Illustrated, inevitably, whether it was the week prior to the Super Bowl or something leading up to the Super Bowl or a big playoff game, they had a tendency to tank. So my father was the exact same way as a big fan of the Minnesota Vikings and the Green Bay Packers is. We got the magazine every week. He would look to see who's on the cover, and if it was a team that he liked, he would do the same thing. He would do the groan. He would throw his money the exact opposite way he would normally bet. We didn't have any food the next week. It was not a good situation.
Well, the magazine mentions another father who joins both of ours, a father named Bill Parcells, who after his New England Patriots won the 97 AFC title game, phoned his daughter, who works for Sports Illustrated in the marketing department, to say two words, no cover.
You got to know Bill Parcells, too. He's such a detail guy that, you know what, right after he won the game, you've got a million things on your mind. You're preparing for the Super Bowl. You're preparing for your next team. That was probably first and foremost on his mind is make damn sure you're not on that cover the next week.
First phone call he makes in the locker room.
And you brought up a good point off air, and a lot of athletes appear on the cover multiple times. You can look at Michael Jordan's been on the cover like 51 times. You know, there's no jinx with Michael Jordan.
No, apparently
but you brought
not.
Up a really good point with Larry Bird, who is probably my favorite basketball player of all time when he played at Indiana State, and then his formidable years with the Celtics before he took on coaching for the Indiana Pacers. I was not aware that if there's a single athlete that has really truly been affected by the jinx. It's the man that I always thought was Mr. Clutch himself, and that's Larry Bird.
And here's a guy who made three covers and had three mishaps.
Exactly.
Well, of course, Sports Illustrated downplays some of this. To quote the magazine, from all we've come to know about Leon Spinks, he hardly needed the bad mojo of our cover, which he graced after defeating Ali in 78 to get arrested twice and lose his next bout.
And I have what I call the Leon Spinks rule, and I believe that everybody should live their lives this way. After he became the heavyweight champ, he got it. First of all, he was an idiot to begin with.
He wasn't a bright guy.
Not the most educated bright guy in the world, and he had a brother that was quite a guy himself. But Leon got busted going the wrong way down a one-way street, and this is the honest to God truth. Whenever I cross the street on a one-way street now, I always look the opposite way of traffic, and I call it the Leon Spinks rule, and I believe that everybody should follow that. Just in case he is lurking in the shadows in this city or any other city in Northern California.
I think it was a drunk driving charge, wasn't it? With a weapons charge thrown into going on something.
He was arrested multiple times. And of course, you know, ultimately, I think it was Michael that eventually got just pummeled by Mike Tyson, too. I don't think it was, yeah, it was, it might, yeah, he got just completely beat up by Mike Tyson.
But
at
he
one
beat
point.
Like Larry Holmes or something.
Yeah, exactly. But he got knocked out by Mike Tyson in about 45 seconds. They got the cash. Who cares?
Well, you got to admit, Sean, in addition to Leon Spinks, the magazine did provide quite a number of numerous and humorous examples of the so-called jinx.
And not necessarily just on the field type things. The jinx extends probably into the whole realm of sports. It not only affects an athlete's performance, but even those surrounding the athletes, those whose jobs it is to do the announcing or the people surrounding the game. One of my fondest memories, and I'll be honest with you, I didn't realize this was the Sports Illustrated jinx until I actually did a little research on the subject. Uh-huh. But it was back in 1983 when the Redskins were on Monday Night Football, and everybody's favorite commentator/lawyer, Howard Cosell, when you look at the work he did with Muhammad Ali and some of the great things he did.
That was some of the greatest interviews in terms of just high comedy I've ever seen in my life.
And there was a mutual respect between those guys. And so a lot of times
each guy was shamelessly trying to use the other. It was a one-upmanship.
Trying to promote themselves, exactly.
Who was trying to, use the other guy?
Couldn't put them both in a room at the same time. Their heads would never fit in the same room. But despite all the great things he did for boxing and Muhammad Ali and really, you know, being one of the innovators of Monday Night Football, the thing he's probably...
He did stand up for Ali in his darkest moment.
Oh, absolutely.
You got to give him credit.
They always supported him.
Yes, he
did. I mean, those guys had a respect for each other. They worked very well together. You had kind of the straight guy, and then you kind of had the clown, and I thought they worked very well together.
Mm-hmm.
But back when he was doing his Monday Night Football thing, and granted, this is towards the end of his tenure on Monday Night Football. He's not a spring chicken in 1983.
Mm-hmm.
But Alvin Gentry catches a pass, is heading towards the end zone, and Howard Cosell, in his ultimate wisdom, says, "Look at the little monkey run." And I was specifically watching that game with my father, and I looked over at him, and I said, did he just call that guy? And we should mention Alvin Gentry is an African-American. I said, did he just call him a little monkey? And then next week, Howard Cosell was not on the air anymore. So
Was that his swan song?
That was it. After that, gone.
Well, I have to say, I really don't think that was a racially motivated comment.
I don't think so either.
But it was just, some people took it that way.
It was just the time.
Howard Cosell, a victim of political correctness.
Hard to believe, especially for a guy like that. And then another one of my favorites is you go back to the genesis of the magazine, which first started appearing in the 1950s. And there was, and nobody's going to remember this guy. I think we both just kind of find this story somewhat humorous. There was a guy named Joe Alston who was an agent with the FBI and also apparently a hell of a badminton player. And he appeared on the cover March 7th, 1955. Well, he was bucking for a promotion within the FBI. He wanted to do undercover work for him. As soon as his picture appeared on the cover of Sports Illustrated, his cover was blown.
Which I would say it was rather thoroughly blown. Well, you it's hard to blame the magazine for that, you know?
How could they have known?
Yeah, who knew? Well, I tell you, when it comes right down to it, they actually Sports Illustrated has, over the years, has taken so much heat for this issue of the Jinx. They've spent some energy and on this issue, spent some time talking to statisticians to explain what this is all about. And then they pointed out rather interestingly that a counterpart to the cover of Sports Illustrated is Lourdes, the town in western France, where more than 100 million pilgrims have flocked since 1858. Now, they point out, statistically, the Roman Catholic Church has certified 66 cases of pilgrims miraculously cured of incurable illnesses by a visit to Lourdes. However, when you run the numbers on 100 million pilgrims going there to get 66 miracle cures, they point out that the odds of dying in an accident on a route to Lourdes is many times greater than the chance of being cured.
You've got a decision to make then if you're going to head that way. I guess. Do you make the pilgrimage and hope you're number 67, or do you take your chances and maybe stay away because you might end up in a car wreck just getting there?
We're going to talk about Lourdes in a future show, but we'll come back to that one. It's an interesting topic of like cures, miracle cures, and statistics. But another thing in closing here, I think I want to just cite the fact that we both would agree that people do sometimes, there is some evidence some people do. In individual sports, are particularly prone to, after appearing on Sports Illustrated, have a letdown in performance. And it could be just because their raised expectations, psychological factors, as you pointed out in the beginning, are important in sports.
Mm-hmm.
And that could account for a lot of the people tanking after an appearance on the cover. It would make sense.
Again, as we mentioned, the mental aspect of sports, especially at that level. I mean, we need to really mention that. You know, I play sports at this level. These guys... That's all they do. That's their living. That's how they make their money. And really, that's what they've been doing their whole lives. And so, the mental aspect, especially if you look at say like golf. I mean, the mental aspect of that game is so difficult.
And even the announcers will get. He's lining up the putt now in the third green. They don't want to disturb the guy who's like 10,000 miles away on the green while they're.
Well, it's interesting because in the article in Sports Illustrated, it points out that nearly 50% of the time. When a golfer appears on the cover of Sports Illustrated, the next tournament or the preceding tournaments, their performance declines significantly. And one of the things that they point out overall in terms of that article is it does happen a lot more on an individual basis than
individual
it does on
sports, course, Olympic athletes, golfers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know,
would make sense.
One of my favorite Sports Illustrated jinxes. You remember 1973 when Evel Knievel was attempting to jump the Snake River in his quote
that's worthy of a whole hour show.
In his quote unquote motorcycle
sports,
rocket.
Right. Yeah.
Well, that believe it or not, he had appeared on the cover of Sports Illustrated the week before he attempted that little fiasco. And
you know, I should tell you, we do have a line to the guy that built that motorcycle.
Motorcycle is very generous.
Motorcycle
by the way.
In quotes. His name was Bob Truax, and I apparently I know one of his relatives, and we may want to get him for a future show. He's quite a character, as you might imagine, building the so-called Sky Cycle.
The Sky Cycle. That was in this day and age, that would have been pay-per-view. Back then, it was built up. I mean, I remember.
Actually, this is worth taking a minute, because a lot of our listeners don't remember. This is way before their time. We should just recap what happened.
Well, it's 1973. I'm assuming everybody knows Evel Knievel. If you've ever seen the picture of Evel Knievel jumping over the fountains at Caesar's Palace in slow motion, breaking nearly every, it looks like a doll on a motorcycle, crash landing, the motorcycle going over his body 4 or 5 times, all in a mess. So Evel Knievel's considered one of the greatest daredevils of all time.
Uh-huh.
And in 1973, they decided that he would
he
take
wanted
a,
to jump the Grand Canyon. The Park Service said, no way.
Yeah, exactly.
So then he picks the Snake River Canyon
Idaho. In
Idaho,
right. Exactly. So they get this, the ramp was made out of particle, plywood. Everything about how that was set up
steam-powered, as I recall.
It was just a disaster. There was really no mathematical formula figured out for the angle of the ramp. They didn't know where he was going to land. They didn't, and the best part of that, well, not the best part, because unfortunately he made it. He made it out alive. Is as soon as that thing clears the ramp, the parachute comes out.
Well, yeah, because there's no way you're going to successfully survive a landing when you're shooting yourself. What is like 3,000 feet across this canyon?
And he had even said they really didn't make any type of preparations for a landing other than a crash.
Of course not. So he pulled the ripcord the second he was airborne.
You got to
respect
that.
That's the only way
like
you're going to live and then become a rich guy.
Yep. And he did. And now you see him, he's a parody of himself now on, I don't know, Motel 6 commercials or something like that. But
I remember, Sean, when Rolling Stone magazine did a subsequent coverage of the event, and I still remember, and I can't maybe get it verbatim, but it's pretty close. The article started as follows. History will record that on December 10th, whatever it was, 1973, American sports legend and daredevil, Evel Knievel, risked life and limb to jump across the Snake River Canyon in Idaho. But history, like the nearby Qualls Park Ranch in Sunset, Iowa, is often piled with horse pucky.
That was a joke from beginning to end, but if you can remember back, just think of the media event, the hype surrounding that. I mean, I think everybody in my family, I mean, we were piled around the TV. And again, these days, you'd pay $49 to see him fall into that canyon. So we were very fortunate back in 1973.
He had David Frost at the bottom. Thank God you're all right, Evel. It's unbelievable.
Well, just getting back to where we originally started this, all this part of the Sports Illustrated jinx, I guess.
Well, in closing, the thing that I thought was interesting was the bit of cold water they threw on the statistics, that a psychology professor, and they cite here, Tim Gilovich, examined another proverbial truth in sports, that you get the hot hand, you're the hot team, when you're playing well, you're hot, mm-hmm. And he did a study showing that, guys that sink 3 baskets are not any more likely on the 4th basket to make it than otherwise. And contrary to what fans believe, contrary to what gamblers believe, that if you throw 3 heads, they figure, well, you're not going to do it a 4th time. The odds are, in fact, 50-50 on the 4th throw like they were. So a lot of what we perceive about statistics in sports is just plain wrong.
When you hear an athlete describe being hot, however, they'll say basketball, the hoop looked as big as an apple, it looked as big as an apple bin, or, they mentally in their head, they claim
they believe
they're
it.
Seeing things much differently peripheral and around them than what other people are seeing.
But I wonder, Sean, if we ask the guy gambling up in Reno that he's thrown 3 sevens, does he feel like he just knows that he's going to throw a 4th one,
If the dice looks as big as the fuzzy dice on his rear view mirror.
He's got control of the dice. It does make one wonder. All right, well, Sean Minton, thanks for coming in. This was a great deal of fun.
Thanks.